You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Lieutenant Colonel John Chambers. Lieutenant Colonel Chambers is a career engineer officer, best sapper winner, and longtime friend. He's currently the commander of 1st Brigade Engineer Battalion in the 1st Infantry Division. I'm excited to have a deep talk about engineers and urban warfare, and especially in high-intensity urban warfare, attack, defend. But, you know, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, John. Great to talk to you again.
Okay, so we go way back, and I'm sure that'll come up from teaching at West Point, our families growing up down the street from each other. Our time even in combat together, so you are a concrete six, and hopefully we get into that. But for all my listeners that don't know who you are, I always start off with, if you don't mind giving our listeners a little bit of a background on who you are and what you've done in the Army up to this point.
Yeah, so graduated from West Point with a degree in civil engineering and commissioned into the Corps of Engineers. After completing the basic course for engineers, went to my first duty assignment at then Fort Bragg, North Carolina, now Fort Liberty. And first assignment was actually with an infantry battalion, 2325 Airborne Infantry Regiment, as their task force engineer. And we were deployed to Northeast Baghdad as part of the surge. So did my time there, redeployed back to the United States. And then I joined an airborne engineer company where I did my platoon leader time and served as an XO and then or executive officer. And during that time, I actually did a no-notice deployment to Haiti after the earthquake in 2010. So got back from Haiti. I went to the engineer captain's career course, followed that up with command of the Army Sapper Leader course, and then a route clearance company in the 5th Engineer Battalion. From there, I went to teach at West Point in the Department of Social Sciences, where we were together again after we first met during that that deployment to Northeast Baghdad. And then when I left West Point after finishing teaching, went to Fort Riley, Kansas, and served a little bit on division staff, and then moved on to be a battalion S3 and a battalion XO in the 1st Brigade Engineer Battalion with a deployment to Poland for Operation Atlantic Resolve. From there, I went to the Kansas City District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, where I served as a deputy commander. And then from there, I went back to Fort Riley, served as the division engineer for the 1st Infantry Division, and then started my most recent assignment when I took command of the 1st Brigade Engineer Battalion here at Fort Riley.
Well, that's a lot, John. That's a whole lot of both combat, institutional, operational experience. And I'm really excited to ask you a bunch of questions, not just because you're my friend, but this topic, you know, is really near and dear to my heart as somebody who has been pushing urban warfare capabilities for a long time and how vital the engineers are to that large scale combat operations and dense urban terrain. And hopefully we help listeners understand how vital they are to a combined arms team to be able to achieve the different goals that you might be given in urban combat, which is, I have job security because I believe it's both the present and the future. But I do have a lot of non-military listeners, and hopefully they understood what all that, those positions that you just went through, which I mean, it's just an amazing career and you're still going. And I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule as a commander to help us understand what the engineers bring to the fight, how vital they are to urban combat. But because I have so many non-military listeners, I was wondering if you could give us a general idea of what the engineers in the U.S. Army do in combat operations specifically, and you know, generally in these, you know, combat scenarios.
Yeah, so what we bring to the fight, really what we're focused on as engineers, is mobility, counter-mobility, survivability, general engineering, and geospatial engineering. So to break that down, what that means, you know, mobility is basically creating a way for a maneuver element, you know, whether that be armor, infantry, creating a way for that maneuver force to get to their objectives. So breaching obstacles, crossing, you know, wet gaps, dry gaps, so river crossings, that's mobility. Counter mobility is, you know, shaping terrain to force the enemy to maneuver where the friendly force wants to engage them and kill them, right? So funneling the enemy into an engagement area or blocking off an area altogether, so denying the enemy entry. So that's counter mobility. Survivability is, you know, fortifying or building up friendly positions to make them more survivable, right? To allow friendly forces better defensive positions, better protection from enemy munitions. And then general engineering is really just construction, right? So that's everything from building combat roads and trails to conducting vertical construction. In the engineers, in the army engineers, we have, you know, plumbers, we have electricians, we have carpenters, we have horizontal engineers, any type of engineer you could think of. And then finally, our geospatial engineers, that's really using maps and imagery to, you know, understand the terrain and allow us to better accomplish our missions of mobility and counter mobility in support of that maneuver commander.
One, I'm just a simple old infantryman, as you know, but that was a lot. And in combat, especially mobility as like getting where you're trying to go, or counter mobility, trying to stop people from where they're trying to go. You know, I think of, but almost every one of those, I think we could do an episode on in urban combat, fortifying your building. So survivability in the urban context, like if you're defending, even the construction of making roads that need to be there to keep lines of communication open or all that, geospatial, like understanding the dense urban terrain, three dimensions. Man, we could really go into it, but I want to give everybody as much of a broad understanding of engineers and what they can bring to the fight. Even from the sense that we, in this course that we teach, John, that I'm sure you're aware of, the world's only course for division and brigade leaders and staff only focused on large scale combat operations in urban terrain. And I know you were a division engineer, so you were probably be the person at the seat of the table saying, look, here's a challenge that you have on this terrain. Here are the capabilities that the engineers bring and can provide the maneuver commander and provide in the mission, which is the whole reason we have this course, the 40th Infantry Division Urban Operations Planners course. I'm not saying I get told to say that, but it's a big project that we've been working on with General Wars for years. And it's really important. And one of the things we talk about is we have like, what are the capabilities? What are the functions that, which is what you just talked about. But can you give us, and again, thinking about those non-military listeners, what are the general engineer assets that we would have in a U.S. military unit based on our force structure, force design for an urban battle? But also in general, from everything from, you know, what size of units and what do they bring to, you know, to even bridging assets.
Yeah. So first and foremost, you know, as a former infantryman, I do need to point out to you that we do have a secondary mission to fight as infantry. So engineers bring all those capabilities to the table, and then we can do your job too. So, you know, I just want to put that out.
Easy now. Easy.
Yeah. So task organization in how we do that, right? So the engineers are going through a bit of a restructuring right now in the types of companies we have. And so normally what you would see with a maneuver formation, so with the armor and the infantry, are combat engineer companies. And so in a heavy unit, so an armored unit that has tanks and Bradleys, you know, what if you would think of as mechanized infantry, right? We bring, we have Bradley platoons with sappers, dismounted sappers in the back, and so they can do explosive breaching, right? They can get to the, they can create mouse holes in urban terrain, you know, really kind of a Swiss Army knife. The dismounted sappers can do a whole host of things. And then those combat engineer companies in the heavy world also bring assault breaching vehicles, which are essentially, you know, on an M1 tank chassis, and they have two Miklicks attached to them. And so we have some of those. We have joint assault bridges, which are also on the M1 chassis. And those are basically giant scissor bridges. So, you know, you and I have talked, every urban terrain you can think of has some sort of water feature going through that, right? Because that's where people congregate in the water. That's where they build cities. And so in an urban assault, we do bring that capability within the joint assault bridge on a tank chassis. And then those combat engineer companies also have, you know, bulldozers. So D7 on the civilian side, their equivalent in the military. And then what we call a HEMI, a high mobility engineer excavator, which is essentially a souped up backhoe that can, you know, drive on the road. So in addition to the combat engineer companies, we have construction companies, which have a broader set of construction equipment. So they have bulldozers, they have scrapers, high X's, and that's where you find a lot of our construction occupational specialties. So the plumbers, you know, the carpenters, the electricians, the surveyors. And then we also have multi-role bridge companies, which are focused specifically on bridging, both crossing a wet gap, so a river, and crossing, we can also cross dry gaps. So, you know, that's what it is, a dry gap, right? So a gap without any water in it. And then we have some route clearance companies for explosive hazards detection, and then route clearance. And we also have canine detachment inside the engineer regiment for which uses dogs to find explosive hazards.
So that's a lot. I have a lot of questions. Number one is, what is the size of the engineer force? I'm a simple infantryman, but like in a brigade combat team, if you're in a heavy, you're an armor brigade, an infantry brigade, and a striker brigade, what are the size of engineer assets I would have available to me at the brigade combat team level, especially in planning?
Yeah, so right now, what you would have in a brigade combat team are two combat engineer companies of about 120 to 150 personnel each, and then what we're moving to is you would assign essentially an engineer battalion against a brigade combat team. And so you would actually have three combat engineer companies within that battalion of anywhere from 130 to 150 people each. And so that would provide you with the dismounted the mounted sappers, right? And Bradley's, and you have dismounts on the back. And then that would give you your assault breacher vehicles and your joint assault bridges. And then at the division level, they would have another engineer battalion with horizontal, the engineer construction companies that do the general engineering, and the multi-role bridge companies. And depending on the mission set, they could slice those companies out to support the various brigades, depending on who's a priority and what the planners think they'll encounter during their assigned missions.
Okay. How many bulldozers could you bring to the fight?
So in the horizontal companies, they're going to bring really four dozers per horizontal platoon, and they have two horizontal platoons. So a total of eight will bring it to the fight. They'll bring to the fight, and that's in those engineer construction companies. And then in the combat engineer companies, they have three dozers each.
Now those are D7s, right? Are they armored, have a cage, or are they meant to be used almost outside of high, you're basically a high intensity fight?
So they'll armor them up. I mean, when we were, you know, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, they added armor to some of them. So they had some survivability. And I think now it would depend on what environment they're in, you know, as we would outfit them for combat, we would bulk them up so that you could use them in an urban environment, in the operators would have protection.
Because, you know, I've been a very big fan of the role of the bulldozer in contested high intensity urban battles. You think even the Second Battle of Fallujah, the Battle of Morari, the Battle of Mosul, one of the most, I don't know if you call it a pacing item, the thing you're tracking is how many bulldozers you have, and really, and you correct me if I'm wrong, for that mobility role, right? Trying to penetrate, trying to get into complex obstacle belts that the enemy has built in the urban terrain because he has access to lots of materials, that bulldozer becomes a pretty critical piece of equipment.
Yeah, 100%, right? So if we think high-intensity combat, you're going to have, you know, buildings are going to be rubbled. There's going to be, you know, just piles of debris everywhere. And so you're going to need something to clear the route so that you can get that combined arms team to the objective, right? So, you know, as you move the tanks along with the infantry through that urban environment, you're going to have something leading the way so that they can go where they want to go and seize their objective. And that ends up being the bulldozer. And frankly, you know, I've even seen them used in, you know, counterinsurgency. So when I was a lieutenant, I got tasked to put in during the surge, I got tasked to put in an obstacle blocking a key avenue of approach into Sadr City. And the insurgents actually breached my obstacle with a bulldozer within 5 hours of putting it in. So I guess it may not be a greatest obstacle, but we didn't have overwatch on it. And so they wanted to maintain their freedom of maneuver and their ability to go in and out of Sadr City and came through with a bulldozer and drove right through it. It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I know you and I have talked about this. So, you know, I'm a big fan of the D9 bulldozer, right? Which is the Israeli Defense Force's very large, armored, even remote control capable bulldozer for entering contested urban environments. They've used them in the past. They're using them right now. In that combined arms team, it leads the way. It can take a shot. It can clear the rubble. But I also have found, like you and I have had to find in all kinds of combat, that there are things in the environment, like there are other bulldozers in the environment, which you may have to know access to, and cranes and other things. I think sometimes we have I've talked about it in the past, but it really applies to you and I, or the experience that we had in the environment when you can contract for heavy equipment. Or, you know, knowing what's in the environment, not just the terrain, but what are the available resources. If I'm telling you, you really need bulldozers, and you just told me how many I bring into the fight. If I was a planner, I might ask, well, how many are in the environment? What kind is it accessible? I know that you and I had to fight that fight with cranes, right? In order to put in concrete, is that the military doesn't come with a lot of cranes, right?
Yeah, 100%. So I think, you know, that's something to think about. You know, every urban area or every city is going to have, you know, an equivalent of a Department of Public Works, right? And they're going to have all kinds of equipment, whether that be dump trucks, maybe some cranes, right? Hiaxes, backhoes, bulldozers. And so our equipment operators know how to use that, or can at least figure it out pretty quickly, right? And so, you know, something that, you know, we key in on as engineers in, you know, our mission analysis as we're doing, you know, the preparation of the battlefield and understanding what's there and what resources are there for us is not only identifying what critical infrastructure is out there so that we can advise the commander on, you know, how to protect it, or, you know, what risks are going to come if it's destroyed in the fighting, or why that may be key terrain for the enemy, but also, you know, where might we be able to find engineer equipment, right? To either get spare parts for ours, you know, because D9 are, you know, the Caterpillar, or excuse me, our T97s are, you know, Caterpillar equipment. Where can we get that stuff? Where can we get parts for our stuff that we may not have or we may run out of? And then how can we gain additional equipment if needed?
Right. All right, we could talk a lot about that. I'm sure this is just a pet peeve of mine, is thinking that you're not taking advantage of what's in the environment. Okay, from this basic aspect that we're talking about, engineer assets that you'll have available, right? Task organization, mission tailoring. You went through a couple of scenarios. Well, I have to mention that you mentioned mouse holes and mouse holing, which is across the history of urban warfare, something that's very common and very important, the ability to put mouse holes in the environment, both for in attacking and in defending. Hopefully, maybe we can do a little offshoot to talk about that. But I really want to get to, what's the difference between our engineer assets, say, and say from like a Russian formation, like the battalion tactical group, or even an IDF? We briefly mentioned the D9, but are there major differences between our engineering assets and other militaries?
So I think we're all focused on, you know, mobility, countermobility, and mobility and survivability. So I would say that the biggest difference, I think, between us and the Russians probably comes in countermobility and in our ability to terrain shape. And for the Russians, that, you know, for them, they use persistent mines. And so we don't, in the U.S. forces, we only use non-persistent munitions. And so that impacts how you can execute some of those counter mobility operations in the way that you would employ your obstacles, or really the types of obstacles that you would employ to get the enemy into your engagement area. Now, when you're talking our engineers compared to the IDF, you mentioned the IDF having D9s, which is a huge bulldozer, but you know they're not necessarily you know, concerned with conducting expeditionary operations, right? So they're not worried about transporting those over long distances. And so, you know, ours are smaller because we got to be deployable and we're thinking about how we move those around the battlefield. Additionally, you know, they have more robust subterranean capabilities just based on the nature of the threats that they have to deal with.
Right. They have a whole brigade basically of what they call special forces engineers, the weasels or Yahalom. We don't have anything equivalent to that, an entire engineering force trained for subterranean warfare?
No, we don't. Not any specifically dedicated force. You know, we've done some training on it out of Fort Leonard Wood, but no specific force that is totally focused on subterranean operations.
Got it. We ramp up, right? We had a school during Vietnam, and I think the engineers were in charge of that, right? Basically the somewhat of a tunnel rat underground warfare school.
Yeah, it's tunnel rats, right? Even in Afghanistan, you had some of the, I can't remember the specific term, but basically the underground irrigation systems you'd have to, you know, send people through. And we have some of the specific equipment, right? So all of our engineers have urban operations kits, which include, you know, Broko torches for thermobaric breaching, right? Basically breaching using heat. We have mechanical breaching capabilities just because underground explosives, because it's an enclosed area, creates some issues with a shockwave from detonation. So explosive breaching isn't always the best option when you're in subterranean environments.
No, I think most people, I think we've done a, you know, I've had Joe Vega and a couple other people. Most people don't even it makes common sense to, like, if you're a military guy, most people don't understand the compounded concussion that would factor into being underground, to include firing your weapon, and you have to have double ear protection. There's nowhere for that explosive force to go. I'm not an EOD and I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn last night, but it just makes common sense that so that's great to know that you guys have a lot of those quickie saws and blow torches or Broko torches and in the assault kits. I wanted to back up real quick and talk about, since I have the expert, so I can't not ask the right questions. What do you think the advantages and disadvantages of using engineers in urban warfare is?
Yeah, so I think the advantages, you know, the biggest advantage is we have the equipment, right? If you want to, you know, create a mouse hole and use, we have explosives to do it. Two, we have those thermal breaching capabilities to cut through the rebar. You know, we have assets to, you know, improve your strong points, right? We have those carpenters who can go in, our sappers can go in, and we can, you know, improve the survivability of positions, right? If you want to put a command post underground, our electricians can wire it, right? And you know, we can help you figure out with the combo guys, maybe how you tie into the networks, right? How do we run all that stuff and set it up? So really, engineers are our Swiss Army knife. And you know, then of course, as I previously mentioned, we can fight asymmetry, right? So we can do all those things. I think some of the disadvantages is our heavy equipment is a high priority target for the enemy, right? They know, you know, the value of a bulldozer in this fight, and so they're looking for it. And then, you know, just by its nature, it can't drive very far on its own, right? So you got to trailer it around, which creates big vehicles or big signatures in oftentimes tight terrain, right, in an urban environment. And so it's not as mobile as some of our other equipment may be, at least as long as it's moving towards the fight. So I think we bring a lot of capabilities to the table, and you know, we're there to support the maneuver commander and allow them to engage the enemy where they want to engage them, to, you know, keep their forces protected. Some of the challenges though are getting all of our stuff into that, in and out really of that tight environment, you know, in one piece.
Yeah, something you said that I know it's in your background, as I visited you once, and we actually went to the construction of a hospital. And I think some people don't understand that depth of expertise that many of the engineers in our formations will have. And I'm not just saying that because I'm an infantryman and I'll do the infantry things and we can discuss that. But you said, you know, one of the things you said was understanding infrastructure, right? In order to have an urban area, as I've defined many times on the show, you got to have, you know, complex man-made terrain, you got to have a population, you got to have the infrastructure to support them. And we kind of, I know sometimes we work a lot of times in like our targeting matrix to protect infrastructure, how vital it is. But we've shown in even in recent history how infrastructure has been weaponized. So like the blowing of bridges, the blowing of dams, we've seen a lot of that in Ukraine. But would you say the engineers are going to be the one that we're going to have a better understanding of the infrastructure and how it can enhance, enable, constrain operations in urban terrain?
Yeah, 100%. Your engineers are the ones who are going to do the engineer reconnaissance and be able to tell you, hey, we can cross tanks on this bridge and we cannot cross tanks on this bridge because it's going to collapse. And so when the maneuver commander is developing his or her plan, we can say, hey, this is a viable avenue of approach for you. This one may be viable, but you can't get your tanks across it. And so you gotta cross here, or we have to put in some sort of bridge, right? We'll be able to do the analysis of, hey, if the enemy blows this dam, this is going to be the downstream effects, and this is what's going to flood out, and this is where, you know, you're going to be constrained in your maneuver, and or this is the damage that's going to be done to the civilian population. And now, especially when it comes to, you know, blowing the dam and that analysis, that's not your normal engineer on the ground in a combat situation who's going to be able to do that, you know, on the back of a notepad. We have reach back capabilities specifically to the Army Corps of Engineers Engineer Research Design Center out in Vicksburg, where we can say, hey, can you help us model this problem? This is the time constraint we're under. And, you know, based on that time constraint, we'll get the best answer back from those professional engineers in Vicksburg, you know, who can help us understand what's going to happen if certain infrastructure is destroyed. The other thing that I haven't mentioned that we have in the engineer regiment is we have a battalion called Prime Power. And so basically the Prime Power are a bunch of warrant officers and soldiers, and then they have officers too, right? But that's not their prime specialty. They just get assigned there like they would any other unit. But they understand how power grids work. They understand, you know, how to hook up generators to critical infrastructure. And so these are the guys that we pre-position on the Corps of Engineers side ahead of hurricanes or natural disasters that we know are going to come, so that we can quickly power critical infrastructure, you know, hospital as an example. And so we also in the engineers have that capability, and you know, those warrant officers who serve in Prime Power rotate back into the tactical force and really reside our engineer battalions, and can help us understand power generation, how to quickly restore critical or power to critical infrastructure as it's destroyed, and really understand that part of the fight.
That's awesome. And I think I hope people start to piece together, you know, when you're talking about urban warfare, there's just so many aspects of civil engineering, engineering in general, that really come into play. And people, I think, don't think about that, about how much, you know, everything from the actual, like you said, reconnaissance of what are the buildings made of in this environment, right? Because building construction can determine visibility, weapons effects, flight patterns, even. It's really a lot more than people, I think, acknowledge in planning. And I want to get to planning. So we often talk about the attack, right? Because we are, most scenarios, we emphasize the attack a lot. But there also is the defense, and lots of people will be defending in any large scale combat operation. In the attack, is there anything that we haven't covered, you know, in a major city attack that the engineer units and capabilities, I know we mentioned a lot that you want to add into, or in case we didn't discuss it before, I really want to ask you, like, okay, what are the capabilities and units and equipment you'd have for the defense, but what about in the attack? Anything that we didn't cover already?
No, I think, you know, really the attack's all about mobility, right? So it's all about, you know, how do we use our heavy construction equipment? How do we use, you know, explosives where it's appropriate to allow us to get to where we need to be, seize our objectives. And then, you know, I think really it's just integrating into that combined arms team with the infantry and the armor, supported by the artillery, right, and combat aviation, how we all work together to achieve those objectives. So I don't think there's any specific capabilities, but I think it's important to highlight, you know, to accomplish a mission, it's a combined arms team, right? It's not just engineers. It's not just armor. It's not just infantry. It's everybody working together to achieve our objectives.
Right. For me, I just want to highlight that as somebody who, you know, watches a lot of people training and has been around the world seeing how urban fights unfold, is that the mobility challenge doesn't stop at the breach on the outside of the city, right? We practice that combined arms breach because it's a very complex operation. And then when the infantry flow in, like, there's no more obstacles that will have to be, no more obstacles that have been dealt with, or the fact that we mentioned mouse hole, and if anybody doesn't know, of course, if they listen to my show, they know that mouse holes are holes placed on walls, both exterior and interior, allow you to flow through buildings rather than going in their entry points, which are usually booby-trapped with IEDs and other things. But it's been a historical way, if you're on the attack, to move through buildings to avoid the streets, the alleyways, the planned traps, and engineers would be a big part of that. Mouse holing, like you mentioned that, but I think the same thing for interior obstacles is that mobility challenge and that need for that, those sappers or, you know, those other engineering assets to be with you along the fight. It doesn't stop on the outside of the city.
Yeah, and I think, you're going to see the importance of mouse holding. You know, if it's not important enough already, it's going to grow, right? Under the era that we're in now of constant surveillance through, you know, drones everywhere, the ability to maneuver inside of cover under those buildings is significant, right? So I think in an urban fight, the importance of that is just going to increase exponentially.
Yeah, and there's actually a lot of where people have to learn the lesson again, and there's been research of, you know, where the main casualties taken in a high intensity, you know, city attack, you know, in the streets and the alleyways. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, developed this, you know, way back in the Second Intifada. Actually, before that, that in order to reduce those casualties, you go through the buildings. They called it an infestation, but it was just, you know, mouse holing at scale to where you're flowing through it. Okay, defense, right? Because I've written a little manual about how to defend urban terrain. And a lot of that manual, if I know you've seen it, is about putting out obstacles, right? Just slow them down, create the engagement areas that you want. What are some of the things that the engineers would bring, both capabilities and equipment, to help in a city defense?
So it's really, you know, on the planning side, it's an understanding of terrain and how you can shape terrain to funnel the enemy where you want them into your engagement area, right? So it's understanding, you know, just like on the friendly side, we need to understand which bridges we can cross. We also know on the enemy side which bridges they can cross, right? Where is a suitable location for them to do a gap crossing, you know, maybe where there isn't a bridge, where they're going to employ those assets. And then, you know, we can take measures to slow an enemy assault, right? So, hey, we know they're going to use this avenue approach. We're going to drop this bridge, and we're going to drop it in a way so that when we go back on the offense, we can overbridge it with some of our assets, right? And so understanding where the terrain is going to limit the enemy's maneuver. And then with our equipment, you know, our heavy equipment, it's creating obstacles to funnel the enemy where you want them, right? Whether it's taking the bulldozers in rubbling buildings, knocking them down to close off avenues of approach. It can be, you know, using cranes or bucket loaders to move around cars, or, you know, whatever you find laying around in the street, right? To make maneuver difficult and to slow the enemy down, right? Are you gonna fix them so that you can attrit the enemy forces while they move through, you know, whatever engagement area you have set up? You know, whether it's, you know, soldiers using anti-tank weapons, or if you're in a place where you can engage with, you know, your tanks or your toes, or, you know, whatever it is. And so I think the biggest thing on the planning side is figuring out how we can shape terrain, where the enemy is going to go. And then on the, you know, the physical execution side of the defense, you know, funneling the enemy, using everything you have to funnel the enemy where you want them to go. And then having built strong points, in survivable positions, using the survivability piece, to allow you to attrit the enemy and kill them, while protecting your own forces.
100%. You know, strong points are historical history rhyming in urban battles across time, because strong point defense, strong points that made of that heavy clad, even picking out which buildings to be using as strong points, I would look to my engineer and say, okay, what do you recommend based on the construction of buildings, their lines of sight, all this stuff? Like, really choosing the right strong point it's not as easy as one might think, and you know, pulling the enemy into, like you said, into your engagement area and engagement area development. I want to pull them into that urban canyon, you know, form the meat grinder, form the wood chipper that I talk about a lot, but now I have the expert on, which I want to get into. Okay, what are the tactics, techniques, and procedures that work best in using engineers in urban warfare?
So, you know, I'll go back to it's really integrating with the maneuver, right? And understanding, you know, how that maneuver commander wants to set up his or her defense, right? Is it going to be a defense in depth where he's going to defend forward with, small anti-tank teams that are going to displace as the enemy comes through, and they're going to trick the enemy as they move into their larger engagement area? And if that's the case, you know, you take some engineers and you put some maybe smaller obstacles out front, you know, just to slow them down enough where you can get off some good shots and you can start attriting the enemy as they get into your larger engagement area, right? So it's understanding what the friendly maneuver commander wants to do, right? First, you got to identify where the enemy is going to come from, right? Their avenues of approach, how you think they're going to do that, determine where the friendly commander wants to kill the enemy. And then you really have to do the obstacle planning, and place your weapon systems, and then conduct rehearsals. And so it all starts with the plan, understanding what the enemy is going to do, understanding how terrain is going to funnel the enemy into your engagement areas, and then how you can enhance the effects of the terrain and shape it, through the placement of those obstacles.
Yeah, you're making me think about rubble. I think you could do a lot of, we could do a lot of talking, even, a handbook on, in high intensity urban combat, in big urban areas. One, how big of a challenge and problem rubble has caused militaries of the past, all the way back to Stalingrad and the Luftwaffe bombing the city so much so that the rubble prevented armor from getting into the city. So that's a mobility problem, right? To how do you do rubbling, like you were just talking about, as a very effective defensive tactic, as in if you want to create, take away an obstacle, counter mobility, rubbling, it's there, the concrete, the steel. I think we could actually do a lot of talking about rubbling to include, like what are the best tactics for fighting through rubbleized terrain? Because I don't know if you're always going to have the time to create the maneuver corridors or what if I was just to ask you, like, what's the best way to fight through rubbleized terrain? What comes to mind?
Yeah, so if I think through that, I think you would have to take your dismount infantry and push them out to create essentially a security bubble in front of your heavy equipment, right? Because it's just your bulldozers are going to be a target. They're gonna want to kill them, right? And so you gotta push your dismount infantry out ahead, create some space, and then it's not just infantry, right? You got to think of what's the air threat? What are the counter small or what are the small unmanned aerial systems that are flying around? How are you going to counter them, right? Do you have electronic warfare assets set up that are going to protect you, because it's going to take you time to clear the rubble, to push it out of the way. We actually did, not in a high intensity environment, but when we were in Haiti, we actually did a lot of this. It was after the earthquake, and think about, just a road with 4 or 5 story buildings on either side, and all of that rubble was collapsed, blocking, key mobility corridors. And so, it took significant, engineer effort to clear those routes so that, people could get around the city of Port-au-Prince when we were there. So, that comes to mind when we're talking about rubbling. And then, what does that look like in a high intensity environment combat environment when you're getting shot at? And so you really got to be able to articulate, hey, if we want to clear this route and this is where we're going to go, this is how long it's going to take for us to clear, a big enough route for us to get tanks and Bradleys and our sustainment through behind them. So you have to create a significant bubble, and then hold it so that you can protect, that engineer equipment while it operates. And then you can bring in the armor, push that forward, and then kind of leapfrog and create another bubble with your light infantry, as you fight street to street, clearing it, moving forward.
Okay, let's do some modern battlefield examples. You see, like I do, there's a lot of lessons to be learned in modern battlefields, but you're the expert. So when you look at a battlefield, just like when I visit a battlefield, I see things. I know you've been following a lot of the same battles I have and wars. From an engineer lens, what have you observed, learned, any surprises from what you're seeing in modern wars?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know if it's a surprise, but it's been really interesting to see it play out in a modern environment. And that's really the effect of terrain, right? The impact of terrain on maneuvers. So I think everything from the initial Russian assault where, you know, as they were coming down towards Kyiv, they were constrained to that single road because of, you know, the wetness of the ground on either side, the inability to go off road, right? Weather impacts on maneuver on the terrain, right? And then even with that, you know, the Ukrainians' ability to destroy the dam, flooding a key avenue of approach, which bought them time to get forces in place, continue to fortify Kyiv. So I think, you know, just watching terrain have an impact, watching the infrastructure have an impact, and then seeing how it can totally desynchronize and unhinge an offensive operation was really interesting. And so it validated a lot of the things that we train on as engineers. And so it was good to see that. Some things that are, you know, really been surprising, you know, is, and I, maybe it's not really a surprise, but just the depth and complexity of the obstacle belts. And so, you know, it really goes to show that when you give someone, an adversary, time to develop a defense, it can be very, very difficult to conduct offensive maneuvers, right? To get a breach and to get back on the offense and be able to maneuver in a way that dislocates the enemy defense so that they got to move. And so, you know, breaching operations have always been costly in terms of men and equipment, right? They're dangerous, they're deadly, and then just to see the complexity and depth of obstacle belts just increases all that exponentially and makes it that much more difficult. So, and then finally, I think tied to the depth and complexity of those obstacle belts is, you know, they're complex, and, you know, really there was a RUSI report that came out last year that highlighted just, you know, the complexity and the disorganization of those obstacle belts. And so it highlights, I think, the importance of engineer reconnaissance, right? Getting, those dismounted sappers, combat engineer, I don't think I hit that up front, but for those non-military listeners, but people who understand, you know, obstacle emplacement and can get out there and validate where the obstacle is, what it looks like, what it's really its composition, its disposition, and then get there on the ground to verify what they're getting through other, you know, intelligence assets, so that they can conduct the most effective breach. So I think it just highlights the importance of engineer reconnaissance.
Yeah, so on both sides, right? So we've seen a lot of, even in modern battlefield, construction of these obstacle belts, right? So the defender developing, even if you look at the Battle of Mosul, one of the reasons it was so destructive in such the biggest battle since World War II up to that point was that ISIS for 2 years had built these large belts of obstacles that were really a big challenge for their executive forces that they attacked, and had to do lots of combined arms breaches and lost a lot of equipment doing that. Now, especially if you look at Gaza and the, you know, 15 years of obstacles and mainly subterranean spaces that are part of that defensive tactics that required a very large amount of engineering assets. I really like the idea too of the, you know, like you said, the high risk operations that are breaching and engineering operations, and where can robotics, and I know that you and other people have been looking at that, you know, from, you know, remote control robotics, being able to create that mobility, or even lay out counter mobility stuff. It's really fascinating. I feel like we've only touched the surface of this, John, and we're already almost at the end of the time that we have that we can do a podcast, and I guess we'll have to have you back to do more. But I hope this gave everybody kind of an engineering in urban warfare 101. What I often say in both my podcast and in my lectures is that, look, if you're looking for all the right answers, I don't have them, but hopefully I'm helping you know the right questions to ask when all of your soldiers and you and everybody else that are out there getting ready for that, what I say is the present and future urban combat. Now you have a little bit more in your rucksack to ask the question about how the engineers will play a role in the overall mission, whatever the mission is. So thanks, John. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.